I dozed, and the phone awakened me. I listened to it ring again and again, but then realized that it could not be for me. No one in the world knew where I was. Finally, someone answered it. I heard noise and laughter. I got up in the darkness and walked to the window that looked down into the windows of the Y gym. Two Negro teams were playing baseball, and a crowd of spectators alternately booed and cheered their favorites. I sat at the window and watched them until hunger began to pester me. The kitchen clock read 7:30 when I passed through to go out to eat. I walked over to South Rampart in search of a cafe. As I turned the corner, I noticed two large white boys sprawled on the front steps of a house across the wide boulevard. One of them, a heavy-set, muscular fellow in khaki pants and a white sweatshirt, whistled at me. I ignored him and continued walking. From the corner of my eye, I saw him get slowly to his feet and angle across under the streetlight to my side of the street. "Hey, Baldy," he called softly. I walked faster and looked straight ahead. "Hey, Mr. No Hair," he called. I realized he was following about 75 feet behind me. He spoke casually, almost pleasantly, his voice clear in the deserted street. "I'm going to get you, Mr. No Hair. I'm after you. There ain't no place you go I won't get you. If it takes all night, I'll get you, so count on it." A deep terror took me. I walked faster, controlling my desire to break into a run. He was young, strong. If I made it a chase, he would easily overtake me. His voice drifted to me again from about the same distance, soft and merciless.
"Ain't no way you can get away from me, Mr. Shithead. You might as well stop right there."
I did not answer, did not turn. He stalked me like a cat. Cars passed occasionally. I prayed that a police car might choose this street. I noted that when my footsteps slowed, his slowed. When mine accelerated, his matched them. I looked for an open door, a light. The stores were closed. The sidewalk, with grass at each seam, stretched ahead from street lamp to street lamp. Then, to my immense relief, I saw an elderly couple waiting on the corner for a bus. I approached, and they stiffened with caution. The quarter was not safe at night. I glanced back to see the boy halted at mid-block, leaning against the wall. "I'm in trouble," I said to the couple. They ignored me. "Please," I said. "Someone's chasing me. I don't know what he wants, but he says he'll get me. Is there any place around here where I can call the police?" The man looked around.
"Who's chasing you, mister?"
he asked irritably. "That boy back there." I turned and pointed to the empty street. The boy had disappeared. The man grunted disapprovingly, as though he thought I were drunk. I waited for a moment, thinking I would catch the bus. Then, certain it had been only a prank, I started down the side street toward well-lighted Dryads, where I knew I would be safe. I had gone only half a block when I heard the voice again.
"Hey, shithead," he said quietly.
I tasted fear and despair like salt in my mouth.
"You can stop right along about there any place, Dad."
We walked on in silence, his footsteps again matching mine.
"Stop right along there. Ain't no nice people on this street for you to hide behind, Baldy."
I searched for some solution and could find none. Something deadly, nightmarish about the pursuit terrified me more than the pursuit itself. I wondered about my family. What if he should knock me in the head, or worse? He sounded diabolic. For an instant, I imagined the expression on some police officer's face as he looked at my black body and read my identification papers. John Howard Griffin, Mansfield, Texas. Weight, 196. Hair, brown. Race, white. Sex, male. Height, 6 feet 1 1/2 inches. Would he think I had merely stolen the papers from some white man?
What do you keep walking for when I told you to stop, Dad?
I knew I should never get away from the bully unless I bluffed. I had long ago been trained in judo. Perhaps if I were lucky enough to get in the first blow, I might have a chance. I saw an alleyway in the dim light and summoned a deep growl.
You come on, boy, I said without looking back. You follow me, boy. I'm heading into that alley down there.
We walked on.
That's right, boy, I said. Now you're doing just like I want you to.
I approached the alley entrance.
I'm going in, boy. You follow me.
I don't dig you, Daddy.
You follow me, boy, because I'm just aching to feed you a fistful of brass knucks right in that big mouth of yours.
I fairly shouted the last words. I stepped into the alley and pressed against the wall, sick with fright. The stench of garbage and urine surrounded me. High above the building's black silhouette, stars shone in a clear sky. I listened for his footsteps, ready to bolt if he accepted the challenge. Blessed St. Jude, I heard myself whisper. Send the bastard away. And I wondered from what source within me the prayer had spontaneously sprung. After what seemed a long time, I stuck my head around the alley corner and looked back along the street. It stretched empty to the street lamp at the end. I hurried to Dryad's and along it to the well-lighted steps of the Catholic church I had visited in the afternoon. Sitting on the bottom step, I rested my head on my crossed arms and waited for my nerves to settle to calm. A great bell from the tower slowly rolled 8 o'clock. I listened as the metallic clangor rolled away over the rooftops of the quarter. The word nigger picked up the bell's resonances and repeated itself again and again in my brain.
Hey, nigger, you can't go in there. Hey, nigger, you can't drink here. We don't serve niggers.
And then the boy's words, Mr. No-Hair, Baldy, Shithead. Would it have happened if I were white? And then the doctor's words as I left his office yesterday.
Now you go into oblivion.
Seated on the church steps tonight, I wondered if he could have known how truly he spoke, how total the feeling of oblivion was. A police car cruised past, slowed. The plaster-white face of an officer peered toward me. We stared at one another as the car took a right turn and disappeared behind the decrepit rectory of the church. I felt certain the police would circle the block and check on me. The cement was suddenly hard to my seat. I rose and hurried toward a little Negro cafe in the next block. As I stepped through the door, the Negro woman sang out,
All we got left's beans and rice, honey.
That's fine. Bring me a big plate, I said, sinking into a chair.
How about some beer?
No. You got any milk?
Don't you like beer, honey?
I like it, but I've got diabetes.
Oh, say, I've got a couple of pigtails left. You want me to put them in with the beans?
Please. She carried the platter to my table and fetched my milk. Though Negroes apparently live on beans and rice in this area, it is no handicap. They are delicious and nourishing. I tried to eat the pigtails, but like chicken necks, they are mostly bone and little meat. Later in my room, I undressed for bed. The game still went noisily at the Y next door. Though the large house was still, I heard the TV from Mrs. Davis's room somewhere on the other side. The whites seemed far away, out there in their parts of the city. The distance between them and me was far more than the miles that physically separated us. It was an area of unknowing. I wondered if it could really be bridged. November 10 through 12. 2 days of incessant walking, mostly looking for jobs. I wanted to discover what sort of work an educated Negro, nicely dressed, could find. I met no rebuffs, only gentleness when they informed me they could not use my services as a typist, bookkeeper, etc. The patterns became the same. Each day at the shine stand, we had the same kind of customers. Each day we cooked food and ate on the sidewalk. Each day we fed the beggar and the pigeons. The widow woman dropped by both days. I gently let her know that I was married. Sterling said she asked him about me, proposing to invite me to her house for Sunday dinner. I stayed at the stand less and less. Among Negroes, I was treated with the most incredible courtesies, even by strangers. One night, I decided to go to a Negro movie house. I walked up Dryads and asked a young boy if he could tell me the way.
"If you wait just a minute, I'll show you the way," he said.
I stood on the corner, and in a moment he returned. We began walking. He was a first-year student at Dillard University, hoping to become a sociologist, to do something for our people. The walk appeared to be endless. We must have gone at least 2 miles when I asked, "Do you live over in this direction?"
"No, I live back there where you saw me."
"But this is taking you way out of your way."
"I don't mind. I enjoy the talk."
When we reached the movie, he asked,
"Do you think you can find a way back?"
"Oh, yes. I won't have any trouble."
"If you aren't sure, I can find out what time the feature ends and come back for you."
Stupefied that he would walk these miles as a courtesy to a stranger, I suggested he let me buy him a ticket for the show and we could walk back together.
"No, thanks. I have to get some studying done. But I'll be glad to come back for you."
"I wouldn't think of it. At least let me pay you something. This has been a great favor." He refused the money. The next morning, I went to the Y Cafe next door for a breakfast of grits and eggs. The elderly gentleman who ran the cafe soon had me talking, or rather listening. He foresaw a new day for the race. Great strides had been made, but greater ones were to be made still. I told him of my unsuccessful job hunting. He said it was all part of the pattern of economics. Economic injustice.
"You take a young white boy. He can go through school and college with a real incentive. He knows he can make good money in any profession when he gets out."
"But can a Negro? In the South?"
"No. I've seen many make brilliant grades in college, and yet when they come home in the summers to earn a little money, they have to do the most menial work. And even when they graduate, it's a long, hard pull. Most take postal jobs, or preaching, or teaching jobs. This is the cream. What about the others, Mr. Griffin? A man knows no matter how hard he works, he's never going to quite manage. Taxes and prices eat up more than he can earn. You can't see how he'll ever have a wife and children. The economic structure just doesn't permit it unless he's prepared to live down in poverty and have his wife work, too. That's part of it. Our people aren't educated because they either can't afford it or else they know education won't earn them the jobs it would a white man. Any kind of family life, any decent standard of living seems impossible from the outset. So a lot of them, without even understanding the cause, just give up. They take what they can, mostly in pleasure, and they make the grand gesture, the wild gesture. Because what have they got to lose if they do die in a car wreck or a knife fight or something else equally stupid?
Yes, and then it's these things that cause the whites to say we're not worthy of first-class citizenship.
Ah,
he dropped his hands to his sides, hard in frustration.
Isn't it so? They make it impossible for us to earn, to pay much in taxes, because we haven't much in income. And then they say that because they pay most of the taxes, they have the right to have things like they want. It's a vicious circle, Mr. Griffin, and I don't know how we'll get out of it. They put us low and then blame us for being down there and say that since we are low, we can't deserve our rights.
Others entered, ordered breakfast, and joined the conversation.
"Equal job opportunities," Mr. Gale said. "That's the answer to much of the tragedy of our young people."
"What's needed?" I asked. What kind of wisdom can overcome the immense propaganda of the racists and the hate groups? People read this poison, and it's often presented in a benevolent tone, even a kind tone. Many sincerely think the Negro, because of his very Negroness, could not possibly measure up to white standards in work performance. I read recently where one of them said that equality of education and job opportunity would be an even greater tragedy for us. He said it would quickly prove to us that we can't measure up, disillusion us by showing us that we are, in fact, inferior.
I wish those kind souls wouldn't be so protective. I know plenty who'd be willing to take the chance of being disillusioned,
the proprietor laughed.
We're about 50 years behind the times, an elderly man said. The social scientists have shown this is wrong. Our own people have proven themselves in every field, not just a few, but thousands. How can the racists deny these proofs?
They don't bother to find out about them, Mr. Gale said flatly.
We need a conversion of morals, the elderly man said, not just superficially, but profoundly. And in both races, we need a great saint, some enlightened common sense. Otherwise, we'll never have the right answers when these pressure groups, those racist super-patriots, whatever you want to call them, tag every move toward racial justice as communist-inspired, Zionist-inspired, Illuminati-inspired, Satan-inspired, part of some secret conspiracy to overthrow the Christian civilization.
So, if you want to be a good Christian, you mustn't act like one. That makes sense, Mr. Gale said.
That's what they claim. The minute you give me my rights to vote when I pay taxes, to have a decent job, a decent home, a decent education, then you're taking that first step toward race mixing, and that's part of the great secret conspiracy to ruin civilization, to ruin America.
So if you want to be a good American, you've got to practice bad Americanism?
That makes sense, too, Mr. Gale sighed. Maybe it'd take a saint, after all, to straighten such a mess out.
We've reached a poor state when people are afraid that doing the decent and right thing is going to help the communist conspiracy, the proprietor said. I'm sure a lot of people are held back just on that point. Any way you look at it, we're in the middle. It's hard for me to understand how letting me have a decent job so I can raise my children in a better home and give them a better education is going to help the enemies of my country.
Walking along Dryads through the ghetto, I realized that every informed man with whom I had spoken, in the intimate freedom of the colored bond, had acknowledged a double problem for the Negro. First, the discrimination against him. Second, and almost more grievous, his discrimination against himself. His contempt for the blackness that he associates with his suffering. His willingness to sabotage his fellow Negroes because they are part of the blackness he has found so painful.
"Want something, mister?"
a white merchant said as I passed. I glanced at him, sitting in the doorway of his junky store.
"Come on in,"
he wheedled, sounding for the world as though he were pimping for the shoes he had on display. I had not gone 10 feet when I heard him solicit someone else in the same tone.
"Want something, mister?"
"Yeah, but you ain't my type," the man behind me answered without humor.
On Chartres Street in the French Quarter, I walked toward Brennan's, one of New Orleans's famed restaurants. Forgetting myself for a moment, I stopped to study the menu that was elegantly exposed in a show window. I read, realizing that a few days earlier I could have gone in and ordered anything on the menu. But now, though I was the same person with the same appetite, the same appreciation, and even the same wallet, no power on earth could get me inside this place for a meal. I recalled hearing some Negro say,
"You can live here all your life, but you'll never get inside one of the great restaurants except as kitchen boy."
The Negro often dreams of things separated from him only by a door, knowing he is forever cut off from experiencing them. I read the menu carefully, forgetting that Negroes do not do such things. It is too poignant, like the little boy peering in the candy store window. It might affect the tourist. I looked up to see the frowns of disapproval that can speak so plainly and so loudly without words. The Negro learns this silent language fluently. He knows by the white man's look of disapproval and petulance that he is being told to get on his way, that he is stepping out of line. It was a day of giving the gracious smile and receiving the gracious rebuff as I asked again and again about jobs. Finally, I gave up and went to the shine stand. From there, I set out to return at dusk to Dryad's, but I had walked too far. My legs gave out. At Jackson Square, a public park, I found a long, curving bench and sat down to rest for a moment. The park appeared deserted. A movement through the bushes attracted my attention. I looked to see a middle-aged white man across the park slowly fold the newspaper he was reading, get to his feet, and amble toward me. The fragrance of his pipe tobacco preceded him, reassuring me. Racists are not the pipe-smoking type, I thought to myself. With perfect courtesy, he said, "You'd better find yourself someplace else to rest." I took it as a favor. He was warning me so I could get out before someone insulted me. "Thank you," I said. "I didn't know we weren't allowed in here." Later, I told the story at the Y and discovered that Negroes have the right to sit in Jackson Square. This individual simply did not want me there. But at the time, I did not know it. I left, sick with exhaustion, wondering where a Negro could sit to rest. It was walk constantly until you could catch a bus, but keep on the move unless you have business somewhere. If you stop to sit on the curb, a police car will pass and probably ask you what you're doing. I have heard none of the Negroes speak of police harassment, but they have warned me that any time the police see a Negro idling, especially one they do not recognize, they will surely question him. This is worrisome, certainly an experience any Negro wants to avoid. I walked over to Claiborne and caught the first bus that passed. It took me out to Dillard University, a beautiful campus. I was too tired to explore it, however, and sat on the bench waiting to catch another bus into town. Buses were inexpensive to ride, and it was a good way to rest. Night was near when I finally caught the bus going toward town. 2 blocks before Canal, the bus makes a left turn off Claiborne. I rang the bell to get off at this stop. The driver pulled to a halt and opened the door. He left it open until I reached it. I was ready to step off when the door banged shut in my face. Since he had to remain there, waiting for a clear passage through traffic, I asked him to let me off.
"I can't leave the door open all night," he said impatiently.
He waited another full minute, but refused to open the door. "Will you please let me off at the next corner, then?" I asked, controlling my temper, careful not to do or say anything that would jeopardize the Negro's position in the area. He did not answer. I returned to my seat. A woman watched me with sympathetic anger, as though she in no way approved of this kind of treatment. However, she did not speak. At each stop I sounded the buzzer, but the driver continued through the next 2 stops. He drove me 8 full blocks past my original stop and pulled up then only because some white passengers wanted to get off. I followed them to the front. He watched me, his hand on the lever that would spring the doors shut. "May I get off now?" I asked quietly when the others had stepped down.
"Yeah, go ahead,"
he said finally, as though he had tired of the cat-and-mouse game. I got off, sick, wondering how I could ever walk those 8 blocks back to my original stop. In all fairness, I must add that this is the only example of deliberate cruelty I encountered on any of the city buses of New Orleans. Even though I was outraged, I knew he did not commit this indignity against me, but against my black flesh, my color. This was an individual act by an individual, and certainly not typical. November 14th. After a week of wearying rejection, the newness had worn off. My first vague, favorable impression that it was not as bad as I thought it would be came from courtesies of the whites toward the Negro in New Orleans. But this was superficial. All the courtesies in the world do not cover up the one vital and massive discourtesy that the Negro is treated not even as a second-class citizen, but as a tenth-class one. His day-to-day living is a reminder of his inferior status. He does not become calloused to these things, the polite rebuffs when he seeks better employment, hearing himself referred to as nigger, coon, jigaboo, having to bypass available restroom facilities or eating facilities to find one specified for him. Each new reminder strikes at the raw spot, deepens the wound. I do not speak here only from my personal reaction, but from seeing it happen to others and from seeing their reactions. The Negro's only salvation from complete despair lies in his belief, the old belief of his forefathers, that these things are not directed against him personally, but against his race, his pigmentation. His mother or aunt or teacher long ago carefully prepared him, explaining that he as an individual can live in dignity, even though he as a Negro cannot. They don't do it to you because you're Johnny. They don't even know you. They do it against your Negro-ness. But at the time of the rebuff, even when the rebuff is impersonal, such as holding his bladder until he can find a colored sign, the Negro cannot rationalize. He feels it personally, and it burns him. It gives him a view of the white man that the white man can never understand, for if the Negro is part of the black mass, the white is always the individual, and he will sincerely deny that he is like that. He has always tried to be fair and kind to the Negro. Such men are offended to find Negroes suspicious of them, never realizing that the Negro cannot understand how, since as individuals they are decent and good to the colored, the whites as a group can still contrive to arrange life so that it destroys the Negro's sense of personal value, degrades his human dignity, deadens the fibers of his being. Existence becomes a grinding effort, guided by belly hunger and the almost desperate need to divert awareness from the squalors to the pleasures, to lose oneself in sex or drink or dope or gut religion or gluttony or the incoherence of falsity, and in some instances in the higher pleasures of music, art, literature, though these usually deepen perceptions rather than dull them, and can be unbearable. They present a world that is ordered, sane, disciplined to felicity, and the contrast of that world to theirs increases the pain of theirs. When I went out that morning, the face of the Negro populace was glum and angry. At the shoe stand, Sterling did not give his usual cordial greeting. His eyes looked yellower than usual. "You heard?" he asked. "No, I haven't heard anything." He told me the Mississippi jury refused to indict in the Parker Lynch case. The news had spread over the quarter like a wave of acid. Everyone talked of it. Not since I was in Europe, when the Russo-German Pact of 1939 was signed, had I seen news spread such bitterness and despair. Sterling handed me this morning's issue of the Louisiana Weekly, a Negro newspaper. The editorial page condemned the jury's actions. "If there was any doubt as to how Southern justice operates in the state of Mississippi, it was completely dispelled when the Pearl River County grand jury failed to return any indictments or even consider the massive information compiled by the FBI in the sensational Mack Parker kidnap-lynch murder case. The axiom that a man is innocent until proved guilty by a court of law has been flagrantly ignored once again in the state of Mississippi. The fact that an accused man was deprived of a fair trial, kidnapped and murdered by a lynch mob from a Mississippi jail, apparently had no effect on the thinking of the grand jury. The silent treatment merely gave approval of the mob taking the law into its hands.
Mississippi has long had a reputation of failing to punish white men accused of criminal acts against Negroes. This is Mississippi's peculiar way of making Negroes happy and contented with the democratic processes and of showing the world how well they care for the Negro and respecting his rights as an American citizen. The point that crushed most was that the FBI had supplied a dossier of evidence identifying the lynchers, and the Pearl River County Grand Jury had decided not to look inside it. I handed the paper back to Sterling. In a voice heavy with anger, he held it at arm's length and read,
"The calculated lack of respect for law and order in Mississippi has made it a veritable jungle of intimidation, terrorism, and brutality, where only the fittest survive. Further, it has shamed the United States in the eyes of the world, and added to the shame of the South, already experiencing strained, tense, and explosive race relations, because white supremacy mob rule substitutes too often for democracy."
He lowered the paper.
"That's what pisses me off. They rant about how the rest of the country's against the Southern white. Hell, how could they help being? Well, this just proves it. This is what we can expect from the white man's justice. What hope is there when a white jury won't even look at the evidence against the lynch mob?"
I could find nothing to say.
"We might as well learn not to expect nothing from Southern justice. They are going to stack the cards against us every time,"
Sterling said. No one outside the Negro community could imagine the profound effect this action had in killing the Negro's hope and breaking his morale. I decided it was time to go into that state so dreaded by Negroes. Joe returned with peanuts to sell. I told them of my decision to move into Mississippi. They jumped on the news almost angrily.
"What the hell you want to go there for?" Joe protested. "That's no place for a colored man, especially now with this Parker mess."
"You're going to treat any Negro like a dog," Sterling said. "You sure better not go."
"That's part of my work."
"I'm telling you," Joe insisted. "I know. I've been there once, and I couldn't get out quick enough. And things weren't as bad as they are now."
"Yes, but Mississippi tells the rest of the world they got a wonderful relationship with their Negroes, that they understand each other and like each other. They say outsiders just don't understand. Well, I'm going there to see if I can understand."
"It's your ass," Joe said. "But I sure hate to see you do it."
"You're going to come back and see us sometime, aren't you?" Sterling said.
"You bet," I said, walking away. A clumsy goodbye. My money was running low, so I decided to cash some traveler's checks before leaving. The banks were closed since it was past noon on Saturday, but I felt I would have no difficulty with traveler's checks in any of the larger stores, especially those on Dryad's, where I had traded and was known as a customer. I took the bus to Dryad's and walked down it, stopping at the dime store where I'd made most of my purchases. The young white girl came forward to wait on me. "I need to cash a traveler's check," I said, smiling.
"We don't cash any checks of any kind," she said firmly.
"But a traveler's check is perfectly safe," I said.
"We just don't cash checks,"
she said, and turned away. "Look, you know me. You've waited on me. I need some money."
"You should have gone to the bank."
"I didn't know I needed the money until after the banks closed," I said. I knew I was making a pest of myself, but I could scarcely believe this nice young lady could be so unsympathetic, so insolent, when she discovered I did not come in to buy something. "I'll be glad to buy a few things," I said. She called up to the bookkeeping department on an open mezzanine.
"Hey, do we cash travelers'
No!
the white woman shouted back. "Thank you for your kindness," I said, and walked out. I walked into one store after the other along Dryad's and Rampart streets. In every store, their smiles turned to grimaces when they saw I meant not to buy, but to cash a check.
It was not their refusal, I could understand that. It was the bad manners they displayed. I began to feel desperate and resentful. They would have cashed a traveler's check without hesitation for a white man. Each time they refused me, they implied clearly that I had probably come by these checks dishonestly, and they wanted nothing to do with them or me. Finally, after I gave up hope and decided I must remain in New Orleans without funds until the banks opened on Monday, I walked toward town. Small gold lettering on the window of a store caught my attention. Catholic Bookstore. Knowing the Catholic stand on racism, I wondered if this shop might cash a Negro's check. With some hesitation, I opened the door and entered. I was prepared to be disappointed. "Would you cash a $20 traveler's check for me?" I asked the proprietress. "Of course," she said without hesitation, as though nothing could be more natural. She did not even study me. I was so grateful, I bought a number of paperback books, works of Maritain, Aquinas, and Christopher Dawson. With these in my jacket, I hurried toward the Greyhound bus station. In the bus station lobby, I looked for signs indicating a colored waiting room, but saw none. I walked up to the ticket counter. When the lady ticket seller saw me, her otherwise attractive face turned sour, violently so. This look was so unexpected and so unprovoked, I was taken aback.
"What do you want?" she snapped.
Taking care to pitch my voice to politeness, I asked about the next bus to Hattiesburg. She answered rudely and glared at me with such loathing I knew I was receiving what the Negroes call the hate stare. It was my first experience with it. It is far more than the look of disapproval one occasionally gets. This was so exaggeratedly hateful I would have been amused if I had not been so surprised. I framed the words in my mind. "Pardon me, but have I done something to offend you?" But I realized I had done nothing. My color offended her. "I'd like a one-way ticket to Hattiesburg, please," I said, and placed a $10 bill on the counter.
"I can't change that big a bill,"
she said abruptly, and turned away, as though the matter were closed. I remained at the window, feeling strangely abandoned, but not knowing what else to do. In a while, she flew back at me, her face flushed, and fairly shouted,
"I told you I can't change that big a bill!"
"Surely," I said stiffly, "in the entire Greyhound system there must be some means of changing a $10 bill. Perhaps the manager—" She jerked the bill furiously from my hand and stepped away from the window. In a moment she reappeared to hurl my change and the ticket on the counter with such force most of it fell on the floor at my feet. I was truly dumbfounded by this deep fury that possessed her whenever she looked at me. Her performance was so venomous I felt sorry for her. It must have shown in my expression, for her face congested to high pink. She undoubtedly considered it supreme insolence for a Negro to dare to feel sorry for her. I stooped to pick up my change and ticket from the floor. I wondered how she would feel if she learned that the Negro before whom she had behaved in such an unladylike manner was habitually a white man. With almost an hour before bus departure, I turned away and looked for a place to sit. The large, handsome room was almost empty. No other Negro was there, and I dared not take a seat unless I saw some other Negro also seated. Once again a hate stare drew my attention like a magnet. It came from a middle-aged, heavy-set, well-dressed white man. He sat a few yards away, fixing his eyes on me. Nothing can describe the withering horror of this. You feel lost, sick at heart before such unmasked hatred, not so much because it threatens you as because it shows humans in such an inhuman light. You see a kind of insanity, something so obscene the very obscenity of it, rather than its threat, terrifies you. It was so new I could not take my eyes from the man's face. I felt like saying, "What in God's name are you doing to yourself?" A Negro porter sidled over to me. I glimpsed his white coat and turned to him. His glance met mine and communicated the sorrow, the understanding. "Where am I supposed to go?" I asked him.
He touched my arm in that mute and reassuring way of men who share a moment of crisis.
Go outside and around the corner of the building. You'll find the room.
The white man continued to stare, his mouth twisted with loathing as he turned his head to watch me move away. In the colored waiting room, which was not labeled as such, but rather as Colored Cafe, presumably because of interstate travel regulations, I took the last empty seat. The room was crowded with glum faces, faces dead to all enthusiasm, faces of people waiting. The books I had bought from the Catholic bookstore weighed heavily in my pocket. I pulled one of them out, and, without looking at the title, let it fall open in my lap. I read, "It is by justice that we can authentically measure man's value or his nullity. The absence of justice is the absence of what makes him man." Plato. I have heard it said another way, as a dictum. He who is less than just is less than man. I copied the passage in a little pocket notebook. A Negro woman, her face expressionless, flat, highlighted with sweat, watched me write. When I turned in my seat to put the notebook in my hip pocket, I detected the faintest smile at the corners of her mouth. They called the bus. We filed out into the high-roofed garage and stood in line, the Negroes to the rear, the whites to the front. Buses idled their motors, filling the air with a stifling odor of exhaust fumes. An army officer hurried to get at the rear of the white line. I stepped back to let him get in front. He refused and went to the end of the colored portion of the line. Every Negro craned his head to look at the phenomenon. I have learned that men in uniform, particularly officers, rarely descend to show discrimination, perhaps because of the integration of the armed forces. We sweated through our clothes, and I was ready to leave and try for a later bus when they allowed us to board. Though nominally segregation is not permitted on interstate buses, no Negro would be fool enough to try to sit anywhere except at the rear on one going into Mississippi. I occupied a seat to myself not far from the back. Muffled conversations sprang up around me.
"Well, here we go into Mississippi, the most lied-about state in the Union. That's what they claim," a man behind me said. "It's the truth, too," another said. "Only it's Mississippi that does all the lying."
We drove through New Orleans under an overcast sky. Air conditioning in the bus cooled us comfortably. As we crossed the bridge, the water of Lake Pontchartrain reflected the sky's gray tone, with white caps on its disturbed surface. The bus stopped at the outskirts of town to take on more passengers. Among them was a striking Negro man, tall, slender, elegantly dressed, the Valentino type. He wore a mustache and a neatly trimmed Van Dyke beard. He walked toward the rear, giving the whites a fawning, almost tender look. His expression twisted to a sneer when he reached the back and surveyed the Negroes. He sat sidewise in an empty seat across the aisle from me and began to harangue two brothers behind him.
"This place stinks. Damned punk niggers. Look at all of them. Bunch of dirty punks. Don't know how to dress. You don't deserve anything better. Mein Kampf. Do you speak German? No, you're ignorant. You make me sick."
He proceeded to denounce his race venomously. He spoke fragments of French, Spanish, and Japanese. I averted my head to the window and watched the country fly past as we traveled through an area of sunlight. I did not want to become involved in any discussion with this strange man. He was soon in violent argument with one of the brothers. They quarreled to the point of rage over whether Juarez was in Old Mexico or New Mexico. The elegant one shouted,
"You can't lie to Christoph. Christoph's got brains. No ignorant punk like you can fool him. You never been to Juarez."
He jumped abruptly to his feet. Fearing violence, I turned toward him. He stood poised, ready to strike the other, his eyes narrowed to slits of hatred.
If you hit me, you'll just be hitting me in the wrong,
the poorly dressed Negro said, looking calmly up at Christoph. His seat companion added with a gentle smile,
He's my brother. I'd have to take his part.
You threatening me?
Christoph whispered.
No. Now, look, the brother placated. Why don't you two agree just not to talk?
He won't say another word to me? You promise?
Christoph said. He lowered his fist, but his face did not relax.
No, he won't. Will you?
The poorly dressed one shrugged his shoulders pleasantly.
I guess.
Don't speak! Don't speak!
Christoph shouted into his face.
Okay, okay,
he said, glancing toward me as though to say the elegant Christoph must be insane. Christoph glared at him for some time before moving over into the seat next to me. His presence set my nerves on edge. He was cunning and apparently vicious, and I did not know what kind of scene he might start. I stared out the window, turning so far he could only see the back of my head. He slouched far down in the seat, working his hands wildly in the air as though he were playing a guitar. He began to sing the blues, softly, mournfully, lowering his voice at the obscene words. A strange, sweetish odor detached from him. I supposed it to be marijuana, but it was only a guess. I felt his elbow dig into my ribs.
How you like that, Pappy?
I nodded, trying to be both polite and noncommittal. He had pulled his hat down over his eyes. He lighted a cigarette and let it dangle from his lips. I turned back to the window, hoping he would leave me alone. He nudged me again, and I looked around. He bent his head far back to gaze at me under his lowered hat brim.
You don't dig the blues, do you, Daddy?
I don't know, I said. He studied me with narrowed eyes. Then, as though he had found some answer, he flashed me a magnificent smile, leaned hard against me, and whispered,
I bet you dig this, Daddy.
He punched his hat back, concentrated, stiffened his hands, palms upward in a supplicating gesture, and began softly to chant,
Tantum ergo sacramentum, veneremur sernui,
in as beautiful Latin as I have ever heard. I stared at him dumbfounded as he chanted the Gregorian version of this famous text. He glanced at me tenderly, his face soft as though he were on the verge of tears.
That got you, didn't it, Dad?
Yes, I said. He made a huge sign of the cross, lowered his head, and recited again with perfect Latin diction the Confiteor. When it was over, he remained still in profound introspection. Above the hum of the bus's wheels on the pavement, silence surrounded us. No one spoke. Doubtless those nearest us who had witnessed the strange scene were perplexed.
You were an altar boy, I guess, I said.
I was, he said, not raising his head. I wanted to be a priest.
His mobile face revealed every emotion. His eyes darkened with regret. The man across the aisle grinned and said,
Better not believe anything he tells you.
Christoph's handsome face congealed instantly to hatred.
I told you not to talk to me.
The man's brother intervened.
He just forgot.
Then to the poorly dressed one,
Don't say anything to him. He can't stand you.
I was talking to the other fellow, the one in the dark glasses, he said.
Shut up!
Christoph shouted.
You were talking about me, and I don't even want you to do that.
Just be quiet, the man's brother said. He's going to be mad at anything you say.
God damn, it's a free son of a bitching country,
the other man said feebly, the smile remaining unchanged on his face.
I'm not afraid of him.
Well, just hush. No need in you talking to him, his brother pleaded.
You keep him quiet or else,
Kristoff said haughtily. My stomach contracted with uneasiness. Certain there would be a fight. I was astonished to see Kristoff cut his eyes around to me and wink, as though secretly he were amused. He glared his enemy down for some time before turning back to me.
I came to sit by you because you're the only one here that looks like he's got enough sense to carry on an intelligent conversation.
Thank you, I said.
I'm not pure Negro, he said proudly. My mother was French, my father Indian.
I see.
She was Portuguese, my mother. A lovely woman,
Kristoff sighed. I see. The man across the aisle smiled broadly at the obvious admission of a lie from Kristoff. I gave him a warning glance, and he did not challenge our friend's French-Portuguese-Indian background.
Let's see, Kristoff said, eyeing me speculatively. What blood have you got? Give me a minute. Kristoff never makes a mistake. I can always tell what kind of blood a man's got in him.
He took my face between his hands and examined me closely. I waited, certain this strange man would expose me. Finally, he nodded gravely to indicate he had deciphered my blood background.
I have it now.
His eyes glowed, and he hesitated before making his dramatic announcement to the world. I cringed, preparing explanations, and then decided to try to stop him from exposing me. Wait, let me—
Florida Navajo, he interrupted triumphantly. Your mother was part Florida Navajo, wasn't she?
I felt like laughing, first with relief, and then at the thought of my Dutch-Irish mother being anything so exotic as Florida Navajo. At the same time, I felt vaguely disappointed to find Kristoff no brighter than the rest of us. He waited for my answer.
You're pretty sharp, I said.
Ha! I never miss.
Instantly, his expression degenerated to viciousness.
I hate us, father.
I'm not a father.
Ah, you can't fool Kristoff. I know you're a priest, even if you are dressed in civilian clothes. Look at these punks, father. Dumb, ignorant bastards. They don't know the score. I'm getting out of this country.
His anger vanished. He leaned to whisper in my ear, his voice suddenly abject.
I'll tell you the truth, father. I'm just out of the pen. 4 years. I'm on my way to see my wife. She's waiting with a new car for me in Slidell. And God, what a reunion we're going to have.
His face crumpled and his head fell against my chest. Silently, he wept.
Don't cry, I whispered. It's all right. Don't cry.
He raised his head and rolled his eyes upward in agony. His face bathed in tears, all of his arrogant defenses gone. He said,
Sometime, Father, when you say Mass, will you take the white host for Kristoff?
You're wrong to believe I'm a priest, I said, but I'll remember you the next time I go to Mass.
Ah, that's the only peace, he sighed. That's the peace my soul longs for. I wish I could come back home to it, but I can't. I haven't been inside a church in 17 years.
You can always go back.
Nah! He snorted. I've got to shoot up a couple of guys.
My surprise must have shown. A smile of glee lighted his face.
Don't worry, Daddy. I'm going to watch out. Why don't you get off with me and let's shoot up this town together?
I told him I could not. The bus slowed into Slidell. Kristoff got to his feet, straightened his tie, stared furiously at the man across the aisle for a moment, bowed to me,
and got off. We were relieved to have him gone, though I could not help wondering what his life might be were he not torn with the frustrations of his Negro-ness. At Slidell we changed into another Greyhound bus with a new driver, a middle-aged man, large-bellied, with a heavy jowled face, filigreed with tiny red blood vessels near the surface of his cheeks. A stockily built young Negro, who introduced himself as Bill Williams, asked if I minded having him sit beside me. Now that Christophe was gone, the tensions disappeared in our Negro section. Everyone knew, from having heard our conversation, that I was a stranger in the area. Talk flowed easily, and they surrounded me with warmth.
"People come down here and say Mississippi is the worst place in the world," Bill said. "But we can't all live in the North."
"Of course not. And it looks like beautiful country," I said, glancing out at giant pine trees. Seeing that I was friendly, he offered advice.
"If you're not used to things in Mississippi, you'll have to watch yourself pretty close till you catch on," he said.
The others, hearing, nodded agreement. I told him I did not know what to watch out for.
"Well, you know you don't want to even look at a white woman. In fact, you look down at the ground, or the other way."
A large, pleasant Negro woman smiled at me across the aisle.
"They are awful touchy on that here. You may not even know you're looking in a white woman's direction, but they'll try to make something out of it," she said.
"If you pass by a picture show and they've got women on the posters outside, don't look at them either."
"Is it that bad?" He assured me it was. Another man said,
"Somebody sure to say, 'Hey, boy, what you looking at that white guy like that for?'"
I remembered the woman on the bus in New Orleans using almost the same expression.
"And you dress pretty well,"
Bill continued, his heavy black face frowning in concentration.
"If you walk past an alley, walk out in the middle of the street. Plenty of people here, white and colored, would knock you in the head if they thought you had money on you. If white boys holler at you, just keep walking. Don't let them stop you and start asking you questions."
I told him I appreciated his warning.
"Can you all think of anything else?"
he asked the others.
"That covers it,"
one of them said. I thanked him for telling me these things.
"Well, if I was to come to your part of the country, I'd want somebody to tell me," Bill said.
He told me he was a truck driver working out of Hattiesburg. He had taken a load to New Orleans, where he had left his truck for repairs and caught the bus back to Hattiesburg. He asked me if I had made arrangements for a place to stay. I told him no. He said the best thing would be for me to contact a certain important person who would put me in touch with someone reliable who would find me a decent and safe place. It was late dusk when the bus pulled into some little town for a stop.
"We get about 10 minutes here," Bill said. "Let's get off and stretch our legs. They got a men's room here if you need to go."
The driver stood up and faced the passengers.
10-minute rest stop," he announced.
The whites rose and ambled off. Bill and I led the Negroes toward the door. As soon as he saw us, the driver blocked our way. Bill slipped under his arm and walked toward the dim-lit shed building.
"Hey, boy, where you going?"
the driver shouted to Bill while he stretched his arms across the opening to prevent my stepping down.
"Hey, you boy, I'm talking to you."
Bill's footsteps crunched unhurriedly across the gravel. I stood on the bottom step, waiting. The driver turned back to me.
"Where do you think you're going?"
he asked, his heavy cheeks quivering with each word. "I'd like to go to the restroom." I smiled and moved to step down. He tightened his grip on the door facings and shouldered in close to block me.
"Does your ticket say for you to get off here?"
he asked. "No, sir, but the others..."
"Then you get your ass back in your seat and don't you move till we get to Hattiesburg," he commanded.
"You mean I can't go to the—"
"I mean get your ass back there like I told you," he said, his voice rising. "I can't be bothered rounding up all you people when we get ready to go."
"You announced a rest stop. The whites all got off," I said.
unable to believe he really meant to deprive us of restroom privileges. He stood on his toes and put his face up close to mine. His nose flared. Footlights caught silver glints from the hairs that curled out of his nostrils. He spoke slowly, threateningly.
"Are you arguing with me?"
"No, sir," I sighed.
"Then you do like I say."
We turned like a small herd of cattle and drifted back to our seats. The others grumbled about how unfair it was. The large woman was apologetic, as though it embarrassed her for a stranger to see Mississippi's dirty linen.
"There's no call for him to act like that," she said. "They usually let us off."
I sat in the monochrome gloom of dusk, scarcely believing that in this year of freedom any man could deprive another of anything so basic as the need to quench thirst or use the restroom. There was nothing of the feel of America here. It was rather some strange country suspended in ugliness. Tension hung in the air, a continual threat, even though you could not put your finger on it.
"Well," I heard a man behind me say softly but firmly, "if I can't go in there, then I'm going in here. I'm not going to sit here and bust."
I glanced back and saw it was the same poorly dressed man who had so outraged Christophe. He walked in a half-crouch to a place behind the last seat, where he urinated loudly on the floor. Indistinguishable sounds of approval rose around me, quiet laughter, clearing throats, whispers.
"Let's all do it," a man said. "Yeah, flood this bus and end all this damn foolishness."
Bitterness dissolved in our delight to give the bus driver and the bus as good as they deserved. The move was on, but it was quelled by another voice.
"No, let's don't. It'll just give them something else to hold against us," an older man said.
A woman agreed. All of us could see the picture. The whites would start claiming that we were unfit, that Negroes did not even know enough to go to the restroom. They just did it in the back of the bus, never mentioning, of course, that the driver would not let us off. The driver's bullish voice attracted our attention.
"Didn't you hear me call you?" he asked as Bill climbed the steps.
"I sure didn't," Bill said pleasantly.
"You deaf?"
"No, sir."
"You mean to stand there and say you didn't hear me call you?"
"Oh, were you calling me?" Bill asked innocently.
"I heard you yelling, boy, but that's not my name, so I didn't know you meant me."
Bill returned and sat beside me, surrounded by the approval of his people. In the immense tug of war, such an act of defiance turned him into a hero. As we drove more deeply into Mississippi, I noted that the Negro comforted and sought comfort from his own. Whereas in New Orleans he paid little attention to his brother, in Mississippi everyone who boarded the bus at the various little towns had a smile and a greeting for everyone else. We felt strongly the need to establish friendship as a buffer against the invisible threat. Like shipwrecked people, we huddled together in a warmth and courtesy that was pure and pathetic. The threat grew as we penetrated deeper toward the center of the state. The distance between the whites and the blacks grew tangibly greater, even though we saw only the backs of their heads and shoulders, their hats, and the cigarette smoke rising from them as night fell and bus lights switched on. They said nothing, did not look back, but hostility emanated from them in an unmistakable manner. We tried to counter it by being warm and kind to one another, far more than strangers usually are. Women discussed where they lived and promised to visit one another, though all knew that such visits would never take place. As we neared Poplarville, agitation swept through the bus. Everyone's mind was on the Parker youth's lynching and the jury's refusal to consider the FBI evidence against his lynchers.
"Do you know about Poplarville?" Bill whispered.
"Yes." Some of the whites looked back. animated Negro faces turned stony. Bill pointed out places in a quiet, expressionless voice.
"That's the jail where they snatched him. They went up to his cell, the bastards, and grabbed his feet and dragged him down so his head bumped against each stair step. They found blood on them and blood at the bottom landing. He must have known what they were going to do to him. He must have been scared shitless."
The bus circled through the streets of a small southern town, a gracious town in appearance. I looked about me. It was too real for my companions, too vivid. Their faces were pinched, their expressions indrawn, as though they felt themselves being dragged down the jail stairway, felt their own heads bumping against the steps, experiencing the terror. Bill's voice cut through sourly.
"That's the courthouse where they made that decision."
He looked at me to see if I understood what decision he meant. I nodded.
"That's where they as much as told the whites, 'You go ahead and lynch those niggers. We'll see you don't get in any trouble.'"
I wondered what the whites in front were thinking. The lynching and the callous decision of the Pearl River County Grand Jury were surely on all their minds. Perhaps the injustice was as nightmarish to them as it was to those surrounding me. We drove through wooded countryside into the night. Bill dozed beside me, his snores adjusted to the hum of the tires. No one talked. After a while, Bill roused himself and pointed out the window.
"That's where they fished his body out of the creek," he said.
I cupped my hands to the window, but could see only black masses of foliage against a dark sky. We arrived at Hattiesburg around 8:30. Most of the Negroes hurried to the restrooms. Bill gave me instructions with such solicitude that I was alarmed. Why, unless there was real danger, would he be so careful to help me avoid it? I wondered. He told me where I should go first, and whom I should request to see. "What's the best way to get there?" I asked.
"Have you got some money?"
"Yes."
"Take a cab."
"Where do I catch one?"
"Any of those cabs out there,"
he said, pointing to a string of parked cabs driven by white men. "You mean a white driver will take a Negro passenger?" I asked.
"Yeah."
"They wouldn't in New Orleans. They said they weren't allowed to."
"They're allowed to do anything to get your dime here," he said.
We walked to one of the cabs.
"Yes, sir. Where can I take you?"
the driver said. I looked through the window to see a pleasant young man who showed no hint of animosity. Bill told him the address where he should deliver me.
"Wait just a second, will you?"
Bill told the driver. He grabbed my arm and walked away.
"I'll find out where you're staying. I'll come around about noon tomorrow and check on you to see you all right."
Again, I was overwhelmed that strangers should go to such trouble for me. I thanked him. He hesitated as though uncertain and then said,
"I'm not butting into your business, but if you're planning on getting a girl, you don't want to get one that'll burn you."
"I sure don't." I thought of La Fontaine's Les Deux Amis, where the friend offers to help rid the hero of his sadness, even to procuring a girl for him. I detected no hint of lasciviousness in Bill's voice or manner, certainly no element of pimping. No, he was simply trying to protect me.
"If you do plan on getting one, you better let me help you find a clean one."
"I'm worn out, Bill," I said. "I guess I'll bypass it tonight."
"That's fine. I just didn't want you to go getting yourself messed up."
"I appreciate it." The cab driver delivered me to an address on Mobile Street, the main street of the Negro Quarter. It was narrow, cluttered, lined by stores, cafes, bars. He was completely civil, and in such an authentic way, I felt it was his real nature, and not just a veneer to please the customer, the way I had seen it in the stores in New Orleans. "Looks awful wild down here," I said as I paid him. I had to speak loudly to make him hear me above the shouts and the amplified wails of jukebox rock and roll music.
"If you don't know the quarter, you better get inside somewhere as soon as you can," he said.
My contact inside referred me to another person in the quarter. As I walked down Mobile Street, a car full of white men and boys sped past. They yelled obscenities at me. A Satsuma tangerine flew past my head and broke against a building. The street was loud and raw, with tension as thick as fog. I felt the insane terror of it. When I entered the store of my second contact, we talked in low voices, though he made no effort to be guarded or cautious in expressing his contempt for the brutes who made forays into the area.
"The sons of bitches beat one boy to a pulp. He was alone on a stretch of walk. They jumped out of the car, tore him up, and were gone before anyone knew what was happening," he said. "They framed another on a trumped-up charge of carrying whiskey in his car. He's one of the finest boys in town. Never drinks."
His bitterness was so great I knew I would be thought a spy for the whites if I divulged my identity. Another car roared down the street, and the street was suddenly deserted, but the Negroes appeared again shortly. I sought refuge in a Negro drugstore and drank milkshakes as an excuse to stay there. A well-dressed man approached and asked if I were Mr. Griffin. I told him I was. He said there was a room for me and I could go to it whenever I got ready.